Hello, it's Friday the 16th of September and welcome to another edition of Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. China's top legislator, Lee Jian-shu, is in Seoul, where he held meetings with the National Assembly Speaker, Kim Jin-pyo, and President Yoon Suk-yeol. We'll have more on these meetings in our news briefing shortly. Coming up on Weekly Economy Review, we discuss the higher-than-expected inflation in the US last month and the continuing depreciation of the Korean won. And then on Movie Spotlight, we have reviews of the action comedy blockbuster Confidential Assignment 2 and the indie drama Kim Min-young of The Report Card. Let's begin Korea 24. South Korea has proposed a three-way meeting with the parliamentary speakers of South Korea, China and Japan. This was an idea outlined by the National Assembly Speaker Kim Jin-pyo in his meeting with China's top legislator Lee Jian-shu, who was in Seoul on Friday. Our KBS World Radio news editor Gu Hee-jin joins us in the studio now to unpack that meeting, as well as our other headlines of the day. Hee-jin, hello.
Hello, Jang.
So I understand that Kim proposed his idea in South Korea's capacity as the chair of the Three Nations Summit meeting.
Indeed. Kim unveiled his idea during a joint press conference after his talks with Beijing's third highest ranking official, Lee, who heads the Standing Committee of China's powerful legislature, the National People's Congress. Lee responded and said that he will seriously consider the proposal, adding that China also hopes to communicate with Japan at an early date. Kim said the two sides agreed on the need to strengthen coordination to boost high-level exchanges and that the parliaments of the two nations should serve as priming water to ensure future-oriented bilateral relations. The Chinese official said Seoul and Beijing must play an active role to bring about a political resolution to issues regarding the Korean Peninsula and agreed to handle sensitive matters in the spirit of upholding respect for each other's key interests.
And later on Friday, Lee met with President Yoon Suk-yeol as well at the presidential office. Mm-hmm. President Yoon said he looked forward to expanding the two nations' mutual interests and expressed hope for deepening the people's trust in each other. It hasn't been revealed yet whether there was any mention of a possible visit by Chinese President Xi Jinping to Seoul. Mm-hmm. Moving on, but staying on the topic of diplomacy, President Yoon will embark on a seven-day overseas trip that will take him to London, where he will pay his respects at the funeral of Queen Elizabeth II before travelling to New York to attend the United Nations General Assembly. We also mentioned yesterday his plans to hold separate discussions with US President Joe Biden and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida in New York. Mm-hmm. What other details do we know of his trip?
Well, President Yoon and First Lady Kim Gon-hee will arrive in London on Sunday to pay their respects at Westminster Hall, where Britain's longest-serving monarch lies in state. They will then offer their condolences at an official state event hosted by King Charles III and Camilla, the Queen Consort, at Buckingham Palace on the eve of the funeral. Yoon and Kim will also be among the more than 2,000 mourners attending the royal funeral at Westminster Abbey on Monday. The president will then head to New York to attend the UN General Assembly and speak as the 10th leader out of 185 UN member states at the general debate. Addressing the assembly for the first time as president, Yoon will pledge to coordinate international efforts towards freedom and democracy. Yoon also plans to publicly urge North Korea to take steps towards denuclearization.
Meanwhile, do we have any more details about his summits with Biden and Kishida on the sidelines of the General Assembly?
Well, according to the first deputy national security advisor, Kim Tae-hyo, Yoon is scheduled to hold separate summit talks with Biden and Kishida sometime between Tuesday and Wednesday. No agenda has been set in advance for these discussions. And although Tokyo hasn't denied South Korea's announcement, it said nothing has been decided on Kishida's itinerary. It will be the first meeting between Yoon and Kishida if they do meet, and also the first between the leaders of the two sides since December 2019. Yoon will then travel to Ottawa for a summit with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on September 23rd as the two sides celebrate their 60th anniversary of their diplomatic ties.
Another topic that will likely crop up during the president's summit with Biden is Washington's recent Inflation Reduction Act and its exclusion of South Korean-made electric vehicles from tax incentives. I understand there were some developments on that front.
Well, South Korea and the US will hold working-level talks on Friday via video conference, and that would be late Friday. This is to address Seoul's concerns over the new US law. The Ministry of Trade, Industry and Energy said that Director General of Trade Policy Yoon Chang-hyun will take part in the talks, along with officials from the Finance and Foreign Affairs Ministries. Officials from the U.S. Trade Representative's Office and the White House, as well as the Commerce, Treasury, State and Energy Departments, will attend the call in Washington. Meanwhile, First Vice Foreign Minister Cho Yeon-dong met his U.S. counterpart, Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman, and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan in Washington on Thursday to ask for their cooperation in efforts to resolve the issue. Cho told reporters that the senior U.S. officials promised to carry on discussions to minimize the damage suffered by Korean companies.
Let's turn to other headlines now. The Justice Ministry will seek revisions to the anti-stalking law as ordered by President Yoon Suk-yeol. This comes just days after the alleged murder of a young woman by her stalker in a restroom at a subway station in Seoul. So what more can you tell us?
Yes, well, the ministry on Friday pledged to swiftly abolish a part of the law prohibiting an indictment if the victim does not wish to press charges in a criminal stalking case. The stipulation has obstructed law enforcement from providing protection for victims in the early stages of an investigation and thus created a window for the perpetrator to instigate the recent attack. On Wednesday, a woman in her 20s was allegedly murdered by a former colleague in his 30s, only identified by his family name of John in Seoul's Shindang station. He was already facing 5 counts of charges, including stalking, illegal filming and threatening the victim. The ministry will seek to enforce an electronic tracking mandate on a perpetrator as a preemptive measure, while the prosecution, for its part, will seek a restraining order against the alleged perpetrator and actively file for an arrest warrant.
In other news, South Korea's senior health advisor suggested a possible end to COVID-19 in 6 months, echoing projections from the World Health Organization just a few days ago. The official called for a strategy for a smooth transition to post-pandemic operations in the country. What can you tell us?
Well, Jeong Ki-seok, the head of the nation's advisory committee on infectious diseases, told reporters on Friday that the time has come to discuss the transition of the daily response system, citing the latest infection and fatality figures. Jeong's remarks echo the sentiments of the WHO Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus, who recently said the end of the pandemic is in sight, after the agency reported a 22% on-week drop in virus deaths worldwide. The senior official pointed to countries such as Britain, Germany, France and the US that have lifted their indoor mask mandates. Jeong expressed confidence that the nation will be able to effectively manage a COVID-19 infectious as a endemic, similar to influenza under the nation's vaccination system.
Still, the advisor did warn of a possible spike in COVID-19 infections around late November that will be aggravated by the seasonal flu.
Indeed. And the Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency, which has been issuing similar warnings, also issued a flu advisory on Friday for the first time since 2019, and much earlier than the typical November or December, the usual height of flu season. The warning comes after the agency upped its flu advisory standards as it braces for what it calls a twindemic this winter, in which case cases of influenza and COVID-19 spike at the same time.
And on that note, can you give us an update on the latest figures?
Of course. The KDCA reported 51,874 infections on Friday, sliding by 18,000 from a week ago and marking the lowest Friday tally in 9 weeks. This brings the cumulative caseload to about 24,316,000. Still, the number of patients in critical care rose by 25 from the previous day to 516, topping 500 yet again just one day after dipping below the line. Thursday saw 60 deaths, raising the death toll to 27,725.
And finally, can you give us the latest Typhoon Namadol update?
Of course, according to the Korea Meteorological Administration, the season's 14th Typhoon Namadol was 800 kilometers east-southeast of Japan's Okinawa as of 3 p.m. Friday, packing maximum winds of 45 meters per second, strong enough to derail trains. The agency expects the current strong tropical cyclone to become very strong as it moves over the warm ocean and hits the southwestern coast of Japan's Kyushu Island by Sunday before moving north of the island on Monday. KMA warned that Namadol may pass through the Korea Strait if the cyclone hits a high-pressure system from the northern Pacific Ocean. Regardless of its route, however, the typhoon will likely bring a downpour of up to 120 millimetres and strong winds of up to 30 metres per second on the southernmost Jeju Island and along the southeastern coast as it nears the peninsula near early Monday.
That's where we'll wrap it up for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates.
Thank you.
On Tuesday, the US reported a higher-than-expected inflation of 8.3% in August, which sent markets tumbling. This also raised the odds of another major rate hike by the US Federal Reserve next week. Here in South Korea, the news was followed by the local currency passing the 1,391 mark against the dollar for the first time in over 13 years. To get reaction to these developments for Weekly Economy Review, we have joining us in the studio now economics professor Yang Jun-suk from the Catholic University of Korea. Professor Yang, hello.
Hello.
Okay, so the US inflation figures for August came out this week. The US Labor Department on Tuesday reported the country's annual inflation rate came in at 8.3% in August. That's down from 8.5% in July and from 9.1% in June. But it was higher than experts had forecast. They had expected 8.0%. And therefore, this led the US stock markets to tumble on Tuesday. The Dow slid by almost 4%. The S&P 500 dropped 4.32%. The Nasdaq sank more than 5%. So, Professor, what do you read into the higher-than-expected inflation for the U.S.?
Okay, well, the difference between the expectations and the actual numbers were really not that large. So headline inflation was not the culprit, but rather the core inflation, the inflation where you strip out food and energy. And the core inflation seems to be accelerating, which caught everybody by surprise. The core inflation for August was 6.3%. That's higher than July at 5.9%. And for the month of August, just by itself, it was 0.6%. That was up from 0.3% in July. And so even though the headline inflation has been reduced, that's mostly because of the reduction in gasoline prices, minus 10.1%. If you strip away food and energy, prices are actually rising, which seems to indicate that the inflation is becoming more widely entrenched in the economy. And I think that set everybody on the edge. Even though people were expecting a 75 basis point increase in interest rate when the Fed FOMC meets in September, this sort of puts the nail in the coffin. Mm. And it also opens the possibility that perhaps there will be a 100 basis point increase in September, which I personally doubt, but also that the increase in interest rate beyond September will be accelerated as well. So what was behind the increase in core inflation?
Right.
Well, shelter went up by 0.7% just in the month of August. And transportation services went up by 0.5% again, just in the month of August. Now, in previous periods of high inflation that we saw earlier in the year, the biggest culprit was gasoline and used vehicles. Mm. But used vehicles actually went down by 0.1% in August. Mm. But new vehicles whose prices were held more or less steady, now new vehicles' prices are going up by 0.8%. And food at home is rising by 0.7%. Food away from home is rising by 0.9%. And while oil prices are going down, natural gas prices are going up 3.5%. So it does seem like inflation is becoming more entrenched and becoming wider than just gasoline and food. Now, this could be because previous increases in oil prices, which are sort of baked into the production process, but it can also be from rises in labor cost, which means that the inflation may be longer than expected and higher than expected. So that, again, has everybody on the edge.
Right. So perhaps we should expect high inflation to prolong at least till the end of the year then?
Definitely till the end of the year. I think very few people were expecting inflation to go back to normal levels this year. I think they were hoping that inflation will die down a bit, and that seems to be happening for headline inflation mostly because that the oil price is coming back down. But the concern now is that, again, inflation may be more entrenched, and then oil prices may rise back up again because what may happen in the Ukraine's, what Russia may do, and how cold the winter may be.
Right, and as you mentioned, this hotter-than-expected inflation figure came just a week ahead of the U.S. Federal Reserve's next rate hike decision. It had been expected that the Fed would implement another so-called giant step of 75 basis points. You're saying that is now pretty much guaranteed, but you doubt that there will be an ultra step of 100 basis points.
Okay, well, yesterday when I checked the Fed Watch, which carries out a real-time survey of market participants on what they think the rate increase will be, 75 basis points was about 75% of the survey. Those surveyed, and 100 basis point, which is a full percentage point, was at 25%. So there is a real concern that Fed may raise the rates even larger steps, the so-called ultra or jumbo step. Mm. I frankly don't think that's going to happen, because if the Fed really had this 100 basis point in mind, I think they would have given signals already.
Right.
But still, this inflation figure has spooked the market. Now, as a bit of a comparison, right after the July FOMC rate increase and before the July FOMC meeting minutes were released, the markets rated odds on 75 basis point increase only at 40%. And 50 basis point increase had a substantial percentage vote. And my feeling is that the market analysts were irrationally optimistic.
Right.
I think the Fed gave fairly clear signals that they were going to raise the rates very aggressively.
Right.
Because the market was overly optimistic right after July, when the meetings came out, when the minutes came out of the meeting, and when the Jackson Hole speech gave impressions that Powell was very hawkish. And this inflation report, that is shocking the optimism out of the market. So perhaps now they're overly pessimistic with the 25% odds on 100 basis points. But it does indicate that the Fed will continue to be aggressive as long as inflation seems to be increasing, especially on the core inflation.
Okay, and then once the announcement is made, we also see how the Korean Central Bank reacts as well with their future interest rate hikes. Meanwhile, as we mentioned earlier, the stock markets reacted to the US inflation data. There was also a reaction in the foreign exchange markets. The Korean won, the Korean won US dollar exchange rate surpassed the 1,391 mark for the first time in nearly 13 and a half years on Wednesday. So the Korean won is fast approaching that symbolic 1,401 mark, and some have even speculated that it could reach 1,501 by the end of the year. How do you view the depreciation of the won?
Okay, I got to admit, before Chuseok, I didn't really expect the won to break 1,400 barrier. I thought maybe it will hit the 1,400 sometime during trading, but I didn't think it would be last for an extended period of time. Now, I have to change my mind. Mm. I think it will hit 1,400 and it will stay above 1,400 for quite a while. The reasons are basically two large reasons. So first, this interest rate reversal. Right now, the policy rate for U.S. and Korea is roughly the same at 2.5. I think the Bank of Korea thought that the U.S. would raise the rates only by 50 basis points. So Korea raised it by 25 percentage points to match the U.S. rate at 2.5. Mm. But now the Fed is expected to raise the rates at 75 basis points, which means that the difference in rates are going to be larger than what the Bank of Korea counted on and what the market may have thought. And then if the Fed continues to go on an aggressive path, then that interest rate reversal gap is bound to be larger. And that may be driven, I think that is one of the major drivers on why won is weakening. The second factor is trade. Now, Korea is now experiencing trade deficit. The trade deficit for August was the largest August in history, $9.5 billion U.S. dollars in deficit. And the cumulative trade deficit is now $24.7 billion U.S. dollars. And the August current account may be in a deficit as well. And I think that is making the currency market traders lose confidence in the Korean won. And that is also another driving factor in weakening of the won. And for other perhaps more minor reasons is that Korea's growth projections are slowing down and the there is now momentum behind slowing of the won. Now, if you look at textbook theory, the won is weakening much too quickly. Mm. And inflation for Korea is lower than inflation for U.S. So the won is, I think, eventually it'll strengthen again, but that might take months or even years.
Right. So in the meantime, is there anything South Korea can do to prevent further depreciation of the Korean won? For example, there has been talk of a currency swap deal with the U.S. Could that be something that President Yoon can secure at his upcoming summit with Biden next week?
I think it will be somewhat difficult because currency swaps are given by the Fed, and Fed is supposed to be independent from the U.S. government.
Right.
But there might be some consideration and some, well, not direct pressure because the, in the U.S. government cannot do that, but there may be some discussions because, well, I think Korea has a lot of reason to be disappointed in the United States in the last 2 or 3 months.
Sure.
And the U.S. right now does need Korean help, not only in economic sphere with Hyundai and Samsung investing in the United States, but also with the diplomatic and military situation around the Asia. So I think if the U.S. is going to give something, it'll probably be a currency swap. But because the Fed is independent from the government, I wouldn't, I'm not expecting it.
Right. Okay. Is there anything the government can do in the meantime, though, for the depreciation?
Well, Korea doesn't control U.S. inflation rates. Korea does not control U.S. interest rates. Korea does not control international demand for Korean products, so it cannot unilaterally increase Korean exports. Korea does not control world oil or food prices. So we really can't do much. Mm. Korea can do something at the margin. If we do get a currency swap, I expect the Korean won to slow the weakening, but not stop it. And Korea can reduce perhaps government deficit, which can increase trade deficit. So it can slow down the weakening of the won there as well. But fundamentally, the important factors behind the won weakening is outside Korean government's control. So they can perhaps slow it down a bit, but I don't think they can stop it.
And very briefly, while on the subject of President Yoon's summit with Biden, do you think we'll see any outcomes regarding Korea's complaints over the U.S. Inflation Reduction Act?
I think it's going to be difficult, if not impossible, and that's because of the political situation in the United States. In order to pass the current President Biden's initiatives, as well as try to do well in the midterm elections, they really need cooperation from all the Democratic senators. And they only have 50 senators, so they need every vote. And apparently there's one or two votes which insist on investment in China being locked out of any type of semiconductor subsidies. Same thing with electric cars that are produced outside the United States. So they need to count on every one of those senators. So even if one senator objects, they can't really do anything about it. If the midterm elections go well for the Democrats and they get a stronger majority in the Senate, then maybe they can modify some of the rules. But if we stick to the current status quo, Korea can't really get anything out of it.
Okay, we'll wrap it up there. We've been speaking to economics professor Yang Jun-suk from the Catholic University of Korea. Professor Yang, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index fell 19.01 points, or 0.79% on Friday, closing the week at 2,382.78. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also fell, losing 11.34 points, or 1.45%, to close at 770.04. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 5.71 against the dollar, ending the day at 1,388.1. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next up, it's Korea Trending, our daily segment looking at some of the other news stories that have been trending online. And for that today, we have Walter Lee joining us in the studio. Walter, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello, Jang. It's always good to see you.
Let's jump straight into our stories today, Walter. What do you have for us first?
Okay, so recent news of a golf tournament that was expected to be held in Seoul's Gwangnak District in late September has sparked controversy among local residents. A pamphlet promoting the event announced that the Gwangnak District office was the official sponsor of the golf tournament and that it would be an event with the flood victims.
Right, so Gwangnak District was one of the worst hit areas by the record rainfall and flooding last month in this whole metro area. And in fact, people are still recovering. But you mentioned that the news of the tournament was not well received by residents.
Yeah, that's right. So although the purpose of hosting this tournament was supposedly to help the victims, residents protested, arguing whether it was appropriate to host such an event while the district was still in the recovery stages of the flood. The organizers of the event, the Gwangnak District Golf Association, also required an administration fee of 260,000 won, or roughly $186, for those wanting to take part. Although the association did state that they planned on donating the money to the flood victims, the sum they intended on donating was around 5 million won, roughly $3,500. This is equivalent to the prize money for the first place in the tournament. Hence, people started suspecting that the organizers mentioned the flood victims only for the sake of promoting the event.
Right, I see. So it's understandable why this was not a good look, particularly as there does not seem to have been any consent or cooperation with the flood victims themselves.
Yes.
Has the district office given a statement regarding the controversy?
Well, the district office admitted to sponsoring the event, but explained that there was no prior consultation on promotional methods or phrases regarding the tournament's pamphlet. Although the district office provides administrative support and necessary expenses, the office claimed that it was unaware of the specific details regarding the poster as it did not directly organize the event. According to reports, the golf tournament has been cancelled.
Right, so they have decided not to go ahead with it after all. Okay, let's move on to our second story. What do you have for us?
Yeah, so Nike has revealed details of the South Korean men's national soccer team's home and away kit designs for the up-and-coming 2022 Qatar World Cup. On the sports apparel company's official website Thursday, a photo of South Korean striker Hwang Hee-chang, nicknamed The Bull, is shown wearing the new home kit. Superstars such as Kylian Mbappe, Cristiano Ronaldo and Virgil van Dijk were also featured. Team Korea was one of a number of teams that had their new kits revealed. Others include Qatar, the host of this year's World Cup, several European teams including France, Portugal, Netherlands and countries from other continents such as Brazil, Nigeria, Ecuador and the United States.
Okay, so tell us about the designs for the Taeguk Warriors new kits.
Okay, so according to Nike, the home kit centers on the motif of Dokkaebi, which is an ancient mythical creature. Now, the company added that the fiery moniker represents the fierce mentality of a proud nation and is amplified by vibrant global red and a tiger stripe sleeve graphic representing strength and power. Mm. An official photo for the away kit has not been released as of yet, but a blue, red, and yellow color scheme is featured. The markings highlight Taeguk, which is the symbol found on the Korean flag and symbolizes national pride. On both kits, the country's name in Korean can be found on the red collar.
Okay, so we still await to see the official design for the away kit. The competition is only a couple of months away now, Walter, and I'm sure fans are excited to see the national team in action with these new designs. Remind us who Korea are up against.
Okay, so the Taeguk Warriors, which is currently ranked 28th in the FIFA rankings, was put in Group H, along with Portugal, Uruguay, and Ghana. Now, they will play Uruguay on the 24th of November, Ghana on the 28th, and Portugal on the 3rd of December.
Okay, let's move on to our final trending story. What else do you have for us today?
Yeah, so Honey J, the leader of hip-hop dance crew Holy Bang, has announced that she is getting married and also having a baby. The dancer, whose real name is Chong Hani, shared a handwritten letter on her Instagram on Thursday announcing that she had finally met the love of her life. She added that a blessing had arrived with this love, breaking the news of her pregnancy at the same time. This took the public by surprise as there were no prior rumours of any relationship surrounding the dancer.
Yes, Honey J, of course, became popular after her team won the female dance crew survival TV show, Street Woman Fighter. Mm. Did she mention who her future husband was in the handwritten letter?
No, she didn't. So the details of the husband-to-be were not disclosed, but she described him as polite, sincere, and a responsible person who she had a lot to learn from. She stated that he was a good person who was always considerate towards her and wanted nothing more than to share this special moment in her life. It is also not clear exactly when the couple will get married, but the dancer said the ceremony will take place by the end of this year.
And you said that she has a baby on the way as well?
Yeah, so Honey J expressed her overwhelming happiness regarding the up-and-coming birth of her child. She stated that she would take full responsibility for this precious little life, which she was gifted.
Yes, congratulations to the happy couple and her future family. We'll leave it there for today's Career Trending. Thank you for those stories, Walter, and we'll see you next week.
See you next week.
Welcome back now to our Friday segment, Movie Spotlight, where we review some of the latest releases at the Korean box office and online. And joining me now in the studio, our esteemed film critics, Jason Bechervais and Darcy Paquette. Gentlemen, it's great to see you as always.
Yeah, great to be here, Django. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Okay, so last weekend was, of course, the long Chuseok holiday weekend, and cinemas were quite busy, particularly with the first film that we're going to be talking about today pulling in over 3 million viewers. That is Confidential Assignment 2, International, or Gongjo 2 International, to give it its Korean name.
It's got a very original title.
So, Jason, lots of sequels this year, and this is another one then.
Yeah, more on that shortly. But yeah, this is a sequel to the 2017 hit Confidential Assignment, or Gongjo, directed by Kim Song-hoon. that performed actually very well in one of the other busy periods for the multiplexes, the Lunar New Year. Now, in that film, Hyun Bin's character is an officer of a special investigation team in North Korea, and he teams up with a team in the South to catch a nefarious criminal played by the late Kim Ji-yuk. Now, in the sequel, it's helmed by a different filmmaker, Lee Seok-hoon, who made The Pirates and Himalayas. The North Korean detective is basically sent on a new mission to track down the leader of another North Korean criminal gang, this time acted by Jin Seung-gyu from The Outlaws, who manages to escape custody in New York while in transit. This is the opening sequence, and then enters South Korea using a fake passport. So, of course, Hyun Bin's character teams up once again with a South Korean detective, played by Yoo Hae-jin, to take down this gang. Now, we've got Daniel Henney as well as the FBI agent, who also joins the team. And Yuna as well returns, and she is also involved.
Okay, so Darcy, there's been no shortage of films this year dealing with inter-Korean relations, actually. There was Hunt, 6:45 as well. But this feature goes international, as the title suggests. It brings in the role of the US to the story. So instead of an inter-Korean cooperation story, this is a trilateral one now with the US. Does this new dynamic work, Darcy? What do you think of the film?
Well, I mean, I guess in some ways it was, you know, the direction that they could go, you know. And it is a little bit unusual to have a film that, you know, is focused on kind of North-South tensions or relations, and then to include the U.S. in a significant way. But it, I mean, it's not very serious, is it? I mean, the film, yeah, I didn't feel a lot that it was new in it, even though in some ways, you know, objectively, they have this big opening sequence in New York. It's on a bigger scale. And yeah, in that sense, it, you know, it is kind of taking on new territory, but it did feel very familiar if you've seen the original film.
Right.
It's pretty much the same thing.
Right. Okay. So, Jason, what do you think?
I mean, it's a very well-packaged film. It's produced by Yoon Jae-gyun of JK Films. He's known as a hitmaker in Korea. He's a filmmaker as well. He produced The Himalayas. He made Haeundae, Ode to My Father. He knows what the audiences want. Mm. And so, yeah, I mean, this year we're seeing films that are certainly well-produced. And that was also true of the Outlaws sequel, The Roundup, which was not only starring Ma Dong-seok, he also produced it. Mm. Yeah, I mean, people are familiar with, obviously, the original film. It has a lot of humor in the film. I think some people may underestimate the power of comedy, and it goes a long way here. It's all very familiar, as Darcy said. I mean, the climatic sequence is so predictable. I'm trying not to give away too much here, but I literally shouted out in the cinema, I mean, this is going to happen, and sure enough, it happened. It kind of reminded me of Shiri in a way. You've got this kind of, you know, this liquid explosive or rather kind of poison. But yeah, it's all been done before. But, you know, you've got Yuna looking very attractive, you know, very pretty. You've got Hyun Bin doing his, you know, North Korean dialect. But it works. This is the thing. It's very effective.
That was going to be my question.
Because I went to see it on, I think it was like a school cultural day. And so it's full of these high school students. And they were just coming out saying, "No, James is so." You know, it's really good fun. And, you know, it's attracting both young and old. It's got the melodrama in there. You've got these, these scenes that take place in this apartment. And you've got the family. And you've got, you know, the interactions, the romance, the humor. It's all there along with the, you know, the local backdrop. And so, yeah, it's a classic localized blockbuster.
Gosh, I guess I was in the wrong screening. I was in a screening with a lot of old people, and it was, like, completely silent. Nobody was laughing at the jokes.
Wow,
so it was a little bit depressing.
Okay, so perhaps it's splitting audiences then, but still, 3 million admissions, that's pretty impressive considering the industry at the moment. Why do you think it is connecting with audiences, Jason? What does it say about the industry at the moment? That perhaps they're looking for something more familiar?
Yeah, no, the industry's in it's a complex picture for sure. Certainly sequels are working at least to some extent. Obviously the Roundup and now this film. And then you have the Han San, which is the Warring Currents prequel. And, you know, Korean films have been known for their originality, and, you know, it hasn't kind of gone down the franchise route that certainly you do have franchises in Korea. But it's, the industry's not relying on franchises that Hollywood very much is. And I think part of the problem is that cinema, a lot of the focus at the moment is on the prices of tickets. And how they've become more and more expensive. I read this interesting article that compared it to the price of jajangmyeon, and how the increase is quite similar actually over the years. But obviously, you know, jajangmyeon is, you know, that kind of base price is now a lot cheaper than a cinema ticket. Right. They've almost doubled since I got here. So I think as a result, people are being very selective with, you know, what they, you know, they're choosing to watch, and sequels, they know what they're going to get.
Sure.
You know, we'll have to wait and see what happens over the next few months. Hopefully we'll have some other hits that are not, you know, big budget films necessarily.
Sure. I guess in the US they have the Big Mac Index. In Korea, I guess it's now the Jajangmyeon Index.
Right.
So we'll leave it there for Confidential Assignment 2 International. Let's move on to our second film, a smaller independent film that has had success on the festival circuit. It's a drama called Kim In-young of the Report Card, or 성적표의 김인영 in Korean. It won the grand prize at the Jeonju Film Festival in 2021, so there's quite a bit of acclaim that comes with it. Darcy, can you tell us what it's about? I understand that this film, like so many Korean indie films, focuses on young people.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically about two friends, like two young women, Jang Hee, who's played by Kim Ju-ah, and then Min Young, who's played by Yoon Ah-jung. And, you know, they turn 20, they've taken the university entrance exam, and, you know, they were part of a poetry club together. They had another friend who was part of their circle who's now in the U.S. But things are changing. You know, Min Young is attending a university. Jang Hee seems to have given up. And most of the film takes place in Min Young's apartments in Seoul, where, you know, Jang Hee comes and spends some time with her. And there's not a lot that happens in the film, but they're great conversations in the film, and the characters are really interesting. It's directed by two young filmmakers, Im Ji-sun and Lee Jae-in, who are from the Korean National University of Arts. And despite the fact that I think that, you know, we have a lot of films that feature similar characters and that do focus on young people, I mean, to me, this one felt quite different.
Right.
It has had some this festival success, you know. After Jeonju, it went to Rotterdam, and then Hong Kong, Hawaii. So it's traveled a bit around the world.
Sure. As you said, the subject of friendship has been tackled before, especially in indie films. Jason, Darcy said this feels different. Does it stand out for you too? What do you think of the film?
Yeah, no, I love how it's structured. Because when I started watching it, because I hadn't seen this film. It's been around for a little while. It's been a film I missed, and so I was watching it yesterday, and I thought it reminded me instantly of Take Care of My Cat, because in that film you have these friends who kind of, as they grow up, they kind of drift apart. And so I kind of imagine what I thought was going to happen is a very similar film, but in fact it's really different. And as Darcy mentioned, a lot of it's set in this Seoul apartment, and they're just talking to each other, but you can see that together that, you know, they don't have the friendship that they once had. Min Young is very much fixated on getting her grades changed. And her friend, meanwhile, is not really doing much. And, you know, they're having these conversations, but clearly the conflicts are arising. And we are introduced to the characters in, like, the first half of the film. But a lot of what we learn about the characters comes later. Mm. And we don't have that kind of dramatic moment that you so often have in conventional films, or even in indie films. And so in terms of the structure, I really admire the film. It felt very, very innovative. And so it was really well written. I mean, it's quite poetic as well, in terms of, because I watched it with subtitles, but I was listening to the Korean, and I really liked the dialogue.
Sure. And Darcy, you said it stood out for you. What about it worked?
I think as a filmmaker, it takes a bit of self-confidence to put forward a film where not a lot happens, and then you rely so much on dialogue and on character. And the fact that this is so successful in doing that, I think, is really exciting. And I mean, certainly as you're watching this, it gives you a lot to think about in terms of, you know, young people in Korea today and what, you know, what they face and what, you know, trying to make some meaning out of life and everything else.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also kind of asks, you know, what it is to be a Korean and how the culture affects you, and your character. And in that sense, it's a very honest film. It really resonated with me.
Yeah, so I'm hoping that more people discover it. We're at the time of year where we traditionally get a lot of small releases, like independent releases. A lot of them come out in the fall. And so it has the potential to be overlooked, but it is, you know, really well reviewed. And I think people who watch it will probably talk about it. So hopefully some word of mouth will help.
Absolutely. Sure. So if you're listening to this podcast, please go and see it.
Sure. I feel the English title is perhaps a little clunky.
It's a little weird.
It wasn't one of your translations, Darcy, was it?
No.
Okay. Just wanted to check. But yes, it sounds like a compelling work. It's called, once again, Kim In-young of the Report Card. And that's where we're going to leave it for Movie Spotlight this week. Jason, Darcy, thank you as always for your reviews and have a great weekend.
You too.
Yeah, you too.
We finish up the show today by looking ahead to what's happening next week in our closing Friday segment, Next Week from Seoul. And rounding up the events for us is our staff editor, Richard Larkin, who's here with us now in the studio. Richard, hello. It's good to see you again.
Hello, good to see you too.
Okay, so what's the first thing we should look out for next week?
President Yoon Suk-yeol will depart on a three-nation tour next week, visiting the UK, US and Canada. First, on Monday, Yoon will attend the funeral for Queen Elizabeth II at Westminster Abbey in London. The Queen passed away at the age of 96 after reigning for 70 years. The President will then travel to New York for the UN General Assembly and deliver a keynote speech on Tuesday. According to the Presidential Office, Yoon is expected to touch on the denuclearization of North Korea in his speech. While in the US, Yoon will meet US President Joe Biden and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida separately in summit talks. Finally, Yoon will visit Canada for the last stop of his week-long trip and meet with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on Friday and return to Korea on September 24th. Earlier this week, the National Security Advisor Kim Sung-han said that the purpose of this trip is to strengthen solidarity with partner countries that share core values and expand the groundwork for economic diplomacy.
Yes, so a very important week for Korean diplomacy with lots on the line. And it will be seen as a major test for President Yoon as well. OK, let's move on to our next piece of news for next week. What do you have for us?
The Ministry of Land, Infrastructure and Transport is expected to announce the Mobility Innovation Roadmap on Monday. This roadmap is expected to show changes to regulations regarding transport in the country and will also touch on the commercialization of urban aviation and autonomous vehicles. This comes as South Korea aims to be the third country in the world to commercialise Level 3 autonomous vehicles by the end of the year, following Japan and Germany. Level 3 vehicles have environmental detection capabilities and are capable of driving themselves under certain conditions. The government is then looking to commercialise urban aviation in 2025 and Level 4 autonomous vehicles in 2027. Level 4 means high automation when vehicles can perform driving tasks at most times without human interaction.
Okay, so potentially an important announcement to lay down the foundations for the future. And what is the last thing we should keep an eye out for next week, Richard?
A US Federal Open Market Committee meeting will take place next week on Tuesday and Wednesday with a further rate hike expected. According to reports, the Federal Reserve could even make an ultra step of raising the rate by 1 percentage point amid concerns of prolonged inflation. The predominant view until earlier this week was for the Federal Reserve to make a giant step of raising the rate by 75 basis points. Eyes will be on the results of the meeting, as the Bank of Korea will also likely further increase the country's interest rate at its next meeting on October 12th. Most economists expect the BOK to raise the interest rate to either 2.75% or 3% by the end of the year as a way to reduce inflation.
Yes, as we mentioned earlier in the show, a very important economic headline to look out for next week. OK, we'll wrap it up there. Richard, thank you for looking ahead to those stories for us and we'll see you next week.
Have a nice weekend.
And we close out our show there. Thanks for staying with us. We'll be back on Monday with the latest updates, analysis of the key headlines from Korea. So we hope you can join us again then. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and we hope you have a great weekend as well. Goodbye.